This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to this edition of the Positive Populist Podcast. That's very difficult to say, right? I'm going to try. Yeah, exactly. I'm going to stop right there. So my guest today, very big honour, Dr. Ben Carson, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development.
Delighted to be with you.
First time we've had an actual cabinet member on the podcast. This is a big moment. Very exciting. So I'm going to ask the same first question I do to all our guests. Are you, Ben Carson, a positive populist?
I am an extremely positive populist. That's what keeps you going, you know, looking at the bright side of things and, you know, having a worldview that says we're going to win.
And what did you, that word populist means different things to different people. When you hear that, what does that make you think?
To me, it means about the people, about what's happening in the society. You're not a hermit.
And so a lot of people on all sides of politics would say, yeah, we care about people. Is there something sort of particular? I mean, when you think about it in the terms of your role at HUD, for example, how do you interpret that?
I interpret it as someone who's also a neuroscientist, who recognizes the tremendous potential of the human brain. There's nothing in the universe that even begins to compare with the complexity and the capability of the human brain. It remembers everything you've ever seen, everything you've ever heard, can process more than 2 million bits of information in 1 second. You can't overload it. You hear people saying, you're going to overload your brain. You can't do it. If you learned one new fact every second, it would take you more than 3 million years to begin to challenge the capacity of your brain. And having something like that, a normal brain can do almost anything. Some people say, for instance, I'm not good at math. It's not true. Maybe you weren't taught the basics of math appropriately, but a normal human brain can easily do calculus or anything else. So, you know, when I look at people in our society and, you know, I see a lot of people not realizing that potential, it makes me want to do things that will change that. You know, for me, reading really turned my life around completely. And I realized that if you can get a young person reading at grade level by the third grade, it changes the trajectory of their life. You know, those who read at grade level at grade three hardly ever drop out of high school.
So when you said it turned your life around, does that mean that there was a time when you weren't a reader, you weren't into books, and then that changed?
That's putting it mildly. I was the worst student you've ever seen.
Really?
You know, the other kids love having me in the classroom because I was the safety net. You never had to worry about getting the lowest mark as long as I was there. And they called me all kind of names. It was pretty awful. But, you know, my mother, who only had a third grade education, you know, she had to raise us by herself. She got married when she was 13, discovered that my father was a bigamist. So there she was trying to raise us. And her cover was domestic worker. She would go from house to house cleaning, but she was really a spy because she was observing these people with these beautiful homes. What do they do? Why are they so successful? And she concluded that they didn't watch a lot of TV, but they did do a lot of reading and planning. And so she came home one day and imposed that on me and my brother. And we were incredibly unhappy, and that's to say the least. In fact, if it were today's day, we would have called social services.
So how old are you then at this point?
I would have been like 9.
Where are we? Just to paint the picture.
In Detroit. 9 or 10 years old at that point. My brother was 2 years older than
me.
And we were not happy, but
what did she say specifically that made you unhappy?
She said, turn off the TV. You can only watch 2 or 3 pre-selected programs a week.
Yeah. No,
and
I'm with you.
Instead, you're going to read two books from the library and give me a written book report every week.
Wow.
And we didn't know that she couldn't read. So, you know, she put little check marks and highlights. We didn't know she couldn't.
No way. So she was making you think that she...
Yeah. But,
that's incredible.
But it had a powerful impact.
Two books a week.
Yeah.
And a written report.
Written reports on each of the books.
At age nine, starting age nine.
Yeah.
How long were the reports?
Usually a couple pages.
Wow.
Yeah. But... it made a profound
difference. And did you choose the books? Or did
yes, we chose the books.
Right.
I remember the first book was called Chip the Dam Builder. It was about a beaver. It's a great book if you get a chance. But I got to the place where I love reading animal. I read all the animal books in the library.
Uh-huh.
And then I went to plants. And then I went to rocks.
Oh.
And, you know, we live near the railroad tracks. And what is there along the railroad tracks? Rocks. So
I would
collect boxes of rocks, bring them home. Learn what they were, identify them, and one day, the fifth grade science teacher, Mr. Jake, walked in. He held up a big black shiny rock. He says, "Can anybody tell me what this is?" Well, I never raised my hand. I never answered any questions. So, you know, I waited for one of the smart kids, and none of them raised their hand. I waited for one of the dumb kids, and nobody raised their hand. So I raised my hand, and everybody turned around. They couldn't believe Carson's got his hand up. Oh, this is going to be good. And he called me, and I said, "Mr. Jake, that's obsidian."
Wow.
And there was silence in the room because nobody knew whether it was right or wrong. They didn't know if they should be laughing or impressed. And finally, Mr. Jake said, "That's right. It is obsidian." And I said, "Obsidian is formed after volcanic eruption, and the lava flows down and hits the water. There's a supercooling process. The elements coalesce. The air is forced out. The surface glazes." They were all staring at me. And it was at that moment that I realized, I said, "You're not dumb at all." I said, "The reason you knew all that stuff, because you've been reading these books." From that point on, no book was safe in my grasp. I read everything
that's
I could get
amazing.
My hands on.
So it's not school, really, and it's reading. It's your mom getting you to do it.
Absolutely,
getting that spark going.
Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing. By the way, I really relate to that. My 8-year-old actually bought. He's obsessed with obsidian. He keeps going on about obsidian. It's so interesting. He's like really into the rocks and so on. And in fact, my eldest son, my 11-year-old, he loves animal books. And, you know, so I can totally relate that. I don't make them do book reports, though. Mm. That's a good tip.
Well, you may not have to because they may be good students already.
That's an amazing story. So is that what really sent you down the path of science that took you to
and my brother
medicine?
Yeah. You know, I became the brain surgeon and he became the rocket scientist.
Is he literally a rocket scientist?
That's what he... His last job was with Parker Aviation.
Wow. So what was the next step after, you read more and more? What took you to medicine?
Well, you know, I was interested in medicine even when I was a terrible student. Mm-hmm. I used to listen to the mission stories in church and Sabbath school. They frequently featured missionary doctors who seemed to me like the most noble people on the face of the earth. And that's what I wanted to do. And, you know, it changed over time from missionary doctor to psychiatrist.
So the doctor thing was quite early on.
It was.
That's what you wanted to be.
And when I got into medical school, you know, I had this tremendous interest in the brain. And I realized I had a lot of eye-hand coordination, the ability to think in three dimensions.
How did you realize that?
Well, in three dimensions, it was because I was so good at table soccer.
That's the least expected answer from a brain surgeon. That's amazing.
And also, you know, I got the chance to work in a steel factory, and it was a summer job.
Wait, sorry, I've got to go. So you would the foosball, that was as a student you were doing the
yeah, and then I got to work in the steel factory, and they let me drive the crane,
right,
which requires tremendous steadiness.
Yeah,
taking tons of steel through narrow areas and putting them on the flatbed of a truck. And,
yeah.
And they said they never let students do that, but they said, "You're so good at it that just let me do it." And so I started thinking, with my interest in the brain, maybe you should be a brain surgeon. And a lot of people thought that was a strange thought. At that time, there had been 8 black neurosurgeons in the world. So it was not a usual pathway. But, you know, I believe that when God gives you a talent, he doesn't care what color you are.
Of course. And So this wasn't, it wasn't like a suggestion of someone else, oh, you may have an aptitude for this. You put those elements together.
I put those together.
And, wow.
And that's what I came up with. And, it just seemed like a natural fit, like a duck in the water.
That's just amazing. I love the food. So that was, that's your medical school at this point.
Yes.
And then you chose the neuroscience. So neurosurgery,
I chose neurosurgery, and
right.
I went on to Johns Hopkins and trained there, and became the director of pediatric neurosurgery at a very young age after having gone to Australia.
Uh-huh.
And that was kind of a strange thing, because when I was chief resident at Hopkins, we had the grand opening of the new neuroscience center, and since Hopkins is like the modern birthplace of neurosurgery, all the big wigs from around the world were there. And one of the guys from Australia, he took a liking to me. He said, you should come to Australia to be our senior registrar. And I said, Australia? You can't. I didn't say that out loud, but
yeah.
I was thinking. So, I said, you know, you drill a hole from Baltimore, you come on Australia. Plus, I had heard they had a whites-only policy. So, I don't want to go there. But it seemed like every time I turned around, there was somebody saying, good eye, mate. I just kept meeting Australians. We would turn the TV on, there'd be a special about Australia. So I said to my wife, think the Lord wants us to go to Australia.
Uh-huh.
So she did a lot of research, found out they did have a whites-only policy, but it was an unofficial policy that had officially been abolished in 1968.
Wow.
So we sold all of our earthly goods and off we went to Australia. Our friends were saying, you'll be back in 3 weeks. But little did they know, we didn't have any more money, so we can come back. We couldn't come back. But the biggest problem we had was keeping up with all the dinner invitations. They love Americans.
Right.
In Australia. And probably the second biggest problem is every time I sat down and start writing in a chart, someone would come up and say, can I feel your hair?
No way.
And I would say,
"That's
you can feel it, but it's going to cost you $10. But I used to always have fun with the Aussies because I'd tell them I couldn't remember any of their names because they all looked alike.
Very good.
But it was a great experience because there were only 4 neurosurgical consultants.
Right.
And once they discovered that I knew how to operate, they did a lot of operating in the peripheral hospitals and left me in the principal teaching hospital. And I was doing like 3 or 4 major craniotomies every day. If I had stayed on the faculty at Hopkins as the low man in the totem pole, I would have gotten what nobody else wanted to do. Here I was doing all these prime cases. So when I came back a year later and the position opened up for chief of pediatric neurosurgery, instead of going out and getting somebody with a big name and a lot of gray hair, they said, well, Carson, very young, but he knows how to do everything. Mm. So it just worked out. It was my wilderness experience.
How amazing. And during this period, was your thinking about policy and politics and government and all this kind of stuff developing in parallel to that, or were you just focused on...
No, I was always very interested. I always followed the political world very carefully. Mm-hmm. And, even my own philosophy changed because, throughout, my life, growing up in Detroit, then going to Yale, in New Haven, then coming to Ann Arbor, all of these are, bastions of liberalism, and then going to Baltimore.
Right.
So, I was a very liberal Democrat.
You were?
I was.
Okay.
But then, as I started seeing so many patients coming in, able-bodied people who were dependent on government, there's something wrong here. And then I did something you're never supposed to do as a liberal. I listened to Ronald Reagan. And I said, that guy doesn't sound like a racist, bigoted, hateful person. He makes sense. And, I began changing, but continue to always look for what are those things that can be done to lift people up, to elevate people, to get people to understand what's going on, and not to think that you're a victim and that somebody else is in control of your life. There's so much of that going on in our society today. You're a victim. They got their foot in your neck. They're holding you down, all that kind of stuff. Even if there are people who are in the way, you can get around them.
Well, what's really interesting about what you said is that I can see how that belief in people's potential, which is something that, a lot of people would say, yeah, we all want to see people maximize their potential. Right. That's not a left or right thing. Mm. People on the right would be more tend more to sort of favor self. Taking responsibility for yourself and all the rest of it. But what I find so interesting is that this is informed for you by the science, the point you made earlier about the brain and the capacity of the brain.
Knowing what people are capable of.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you take somebody with a mindset of can-doism, you can put them in some pretty bad situations. They're going to find their way out of there. And if you take somebody who has a defeatist attitude, you can put them in a good situation, they'll find a way into a bad situation.
Right. And so when you were hearing, was that when he was president or running for president? What, roughly when was
that? That's when he was president. That was around, 84.
And did you sort of do anything about that, or did you sort of privately start?
No, just privately started changing my thought. I actually don't think that there are huge differences between the most radical left winger and the most conservative right winger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they agree on most things. But what we've done is if we've let that 10% of things that they don't agree on, we've allowed the purveyors of hatred and division to magnify those things and make people think that that's the most important thing. And it concerns me. Because our country is very strong. It's actually doing very well economically. Mm-hmm. The only thing that can derail us is us.
Right.
And, there seems to be a lot of forces trying to make that happen.
When was the first time that you put yourself out there in the arena, in the political arena?
Well, I had no thought about politics whatsoever. And then in 2013, I was asked to speak at the National Prayer Breakfast, which I thought was very strange because I had spoken at the National Prayer Breakfast in 1997. I wasn't aware anybody ever did it twice.
Right.
Research demonstrated there was one person who did it twice, and that was Billy Graham. So I said, that's pretty good company. So I said, Lord, what do you want me to say? I had no idea what I was going to say. I didn't know until the morning of the prayer breakfast, and then it was very clear to me at that point people started saying after the speech, you need to run for office.
And wow.
I didn't want to run for office. I said, if I ignore them, it'll go away. But it didn't go away. It kept multiplying. And then I said, Lord, I don't have any of the things that people run for president have. I don't have a Rolodex with all the contacts, and I have a big campaign fund. I don't have an organization. I said, if you want me to run, you got to provide all that. The next thing I knew, it was all there.
Wow.
And so it was very interesting. But, running for president was an interesting experience. But one of the most positive things about it was getting to know people across this country and what motivated people. And really, it gives me a lot of confidence in the American people.
Mm-hmm.
From Montana to Florida to Michigan, really, really good people. And that's one of the reasons that even though I wanted to remain in the private sector after the presidential race and had just all kinds of wonderful things going on, I realized that we have a responsibility to the people who are coming after us, and particularly to the children. And my whole professional career was aimed at the well-being of children and recognizing what kind of country are we going to leave for them if we all just live in comfort and if we don't do whatever it is that we can do to improve the atmosphere for those who are coming after us. And, that's why I wanted to do it. And of all the federal agencies, HUD seemed to be the best place to be able to do that and to really be able to help people.
So did you have your pick of them, or was that the one that
the president told me early on, what do you want to do?
It's not a bad way to start the conversation.
Yeah, but I just figured This is where we can really change the trajectory, and help people to climb that ladder of self-sufficiency and not yank the ladder out as soon as they start climbing it, mm-hmm. which has been done so many times before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, by people who meant well, mm-hmm. but perhaps weren't looking at the total effect of what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's why you have people who say, well, I'm not climbing that ladder. They're going to yank my... I'm just going to stay here
yeah.
for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, whatever. And, you know, those are the people I'm talking about who have yeah. so much potential, who have those incredible brains, who could be doing all kinds of things.
It feels to me like if you could meet those people one at a time, you could give them that message. You could inspire them with that idea. How do you sort of convey that through this massive bureaucracy?
Well, it's a tough job, believe me. I wish all those people had my mother. We wouldn't have any issues. But it's a difficult job because, you know, we're in our system was designed for people to have different opinions, mm-hmm. to have disagreements, to be able to work those things out. Our system was not designed for resistance, for if you believe it, then I don't believe it. If right. you want it, then I don't want it. It was not designed for that. So we're in a very precarious place right now. And it's going to require somebody has to be the adult. It can't be tit for tat. If it continues to be tit for tat, we're doomed.
And so what's been your, you know, just professionally, this job compared to what you've done before? What are the things that are really different about it, or perhaps the same?
There are some things that are the same in the sense that in my previous job, you had an opportunity to give people a second chance at life, many of whom were dying. Mm-hmm. And in this job, you have a chance to give a lot more people mm-hmm. an opportunity. And they're both very difficult jobs.
Yeah.
And they both require a lot of dedicated people. You know, you're just one person. I happen to be the secretary at HUD, but, you know, I could not do this job without a lot of other extremely talented and dedicated people, just like as a neurosurgeon.
Yeah.
I could not do the operations by myself.
And now you said you were going to be leaving. What's next for you?
Well, I said that my preference was to be back in the private sector.
Okay.
But I didn't actually say I was leaving.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood that.
Well, a lot of people in the media misunderstood
okay.
that. I think it was intentionally made to look that way.
Uh-huh.
You know, obviously, you know, we got to get this ship turned around
yeah.
and sailing in the right direction. And, you know, I'll be here as long as it takes to get that done. I hope we can get it done quickly.
So even if the president is reelected beyond, you know, into his second term, if wants you to do it.
Yes.
Well, I personally, just hearing you talk about it and how you see it, I think that has just got to be good news for a lot of people if that were to be the case. Ben Carson, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure.
It's been great being with you. Thank you.
Thanks.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.